Moncrief on News Talk.
Brought to you by Avant Money. Think you're getting the best value from your bank? Think again.
Calm now. Unless you've just emerged from your cave, you'll know that Ireland, but particularly Cork, is celebrating the Olympic gold won by Paul O'Donovan and Fintan McCarthy. But this is far from the first time that Cork has brought international sporting glory to the country. In fact, Ireland's first Olympic gold was won in 1928 from Pat O'Callaghan, a man who, by all accounts, was an extraordinary athlete. And from Cork, Dave Hannigan is a professor of history at Suffolk Community College at Long Island, and he joins us now on News Talk. Good afternoon, Dave.
Good afternoon, Sean.
Judging from his early life, Pat O'Callaghan could have done anything. He was such a natural athlete.
Yeah, well, Dr. Pat, as I suppose most people would know him, grew up in North Cork. Hunting, fishing and poaching, I think, was one description of his childhood, and that then lent itself to athletic prowess, you know, and athletics was huge in Ireland at the time. He was a fantastic hurdler, discus thrower. He was a great footballer. He literally could turn his hand to anything. One of these great natural athletes whose upbringing, I suppose, lent itself to enhancing all of his physical attributes. And then obviously that set him on the road towards Olympic greatness.
And is there any particular reason why he decided then to take up the hammer?
The amazing thing about Dr. Pat and the hammer is he won an Olympic gold in 1928, and the record shows he picked up a hammer for the first time in 1926. He competed in the hammer for the first time 13 months before the Olympics. There's one story that he was out in UCD and he saw the hammer being thrown, and then he basically snuck a go himself when nobody was looking, and suddenly, you know, within 2 years was the best hammer thrower in the world. And at one point as well, he was studying in the Royal College of Surgeons, and one day he came out and there was a very dapper, well-dressed gentleman called John Talon, who was a tailor, and he stopped him and said, "I want to help you with your hammer throwing." And this man, who had never thrown the hammer, became his coach. And that's how he conquered the world of hammer throwing.
Right.
1928,
1932. But he went to the Olympic Games with his brothers as well. They were pretty good athletes too.
The whole family were, and you know, if you want to go back in his bloodlines, they were, you know, his older siblings, Sean and Con, were great sportsmen. His mother's brother was an All-Ireland sprint champion. You know, there was a lot of kind of, you know, sporting genes in the O'Callaghan family on both sides. And then obviously, you know, he was the best of them all.
Yeah. And as I understand it, because it sounds like a very sportsmanlike gesture, when he won the gold up to his second throw, he'd been behind this Swede, but then he used the Swede's hammer. I assume it was with the Swede's permission.
Yeah, I think that was Ossian's gold. It was a different time, you know.
They were a lot more.
Obviously, I think, you know, people would have been traveling together, and you know what I mean. There would have been much more openness, I think, and much more camaraderie at that point. It wouldn't, you know, nowadays athletes are closeted and kind of closed off from their rivals. I don't think that was the case back then. I mean, in 1932, himself and Bob Tisdall held up the entire Olympics in Los Angeles while they filed down Dr. Pat's spikes, which were giving him trouble on the day. And they literally stopped the Olympics and the crowd looked on while Bob Tisdall, who was a gold medalist himself, and Callaghan went to work filing down the spikes. You couldn't imagine with TV cameras waiting for the action today that would be allowed to happen.
Now, and so he did win the second gold in Los Angeles, as you say. By that stage, had he become a very well-known name in the US as well as in Ireland?
Oh, absolutely. I think the fact that the second Olympics was in Los Angeles and the home of Hollywood and the entertainment industry, all of that immediately, you know, enhanced his celebrity. And, you know, there was a well-worn path, really, from sport into Hollywood. And Sam Goldwyn wanted him to replace Johnny Weissmuller as Tarzan, which would have greatly, you know, I remember watching the Tarzan movies on Saturday mornings in the 70s and 80s, and it would have been fantastic if Tarzan was being played by a fellow from North Cork rather than Johnny Weissmuller. But he turned it down. He went playing handball with Bing Crosby. I mean, he was He was the unquestioned star of that Olympic Games and literally could have done anything thereafter. You know, the world kind of, that world was open to him if he wanted it. You know, every door in Hollywood was open to him if he wanted to walk through it. But of course he didn't. I mean, he was a doctor by profession. And that, you know, and that's what he came back to Ireland to do.
And so he wanted, obviously, though, to continue being an athlete. That seemed to have been a bit derailed by politics.
Yeah, not the first Irish athlete to be derailed by Irish sporting politicians. He didn't compete in the 1936 Olympics, the Hitler Olympics, if you want to call them that, because there was a split in the NACA, which was the governing body of Irish athletics, was suspended from international competition. So he sat out that one. And the really tragedy of that was he set a world record after that Olympics. So he was still in his prime in terms of throwing and undoubtedly would have been the hot favourite to win a third Olympic medal in the hammer in the Berlin Games. You know, if it wasn't for like the political infighting and shenanigans that cost him his participation in that tournament.
Yeah, and is it correct that the NACAI were disqualified from international competition because they were claiming jurisdiction over the North and the AAAs in Britain were claiming jurisdiction over the North?
Yeah. Yes, it was... It was the old partition, the old partition problem, you know.
Yes. Now, right, so he couldn't participate in the third Olympic Games, but then suddenly pivots, so to pardon the pun, and becomes a wrestler.
Yeah, like I said, in 1932, every door was open to him in the sports and entertainment industry in America because they thought that he was a kind of a superman who was capable of anything. And the wrestlers were after him, the wrestling community or the wrestling promoters were after him for years, since 1932. And they'd made several attempts to lure him to America with big money offers, etc. And one time, one of them came and ended up taking back Dan O'Mahony, another Cork man, in his stead because he couldn't get Dr. Pat to kind of come with him. But in 1938, his life had reached a kind of a strange situation. There was a terrible incident involving a young boy at a tournament in Mallow. The young boy was hit by a hammer and badly hurt. So O'Callaghan retired from the sport after that. And then, again, another offer was on the table. I think there was financial... You know, there was an issue of compensation for the young boy and his family, and the promoters came calling, and this time they got him. They got him to America in 1938, finally. And I mean, it's astonishing to think, you know, given how much larger the world was then and how not connected we were, you know, when you look into the newspaper coverage of his before his arrival, the anticipation of his arrival in all the major American newspapers, you know, just to give you an idea of what they thought of him, they didn't know whether he was coming to conquer boxing and dethrone Joe Louis or whether he was coming to conquer wrestling. Think about that. Like they believed he could do either. You know, either path was open to him. Once he touched down, or once he sailed into America, they believed, you know, we were not even sure what he's going to do. He was a mythical kind of creature to these American to American journalists, and you know, some of the coverage at the time. I mean, I wrote a piece for the Irish Times, and I quoted this guy Grant Landrice, who would have been the Con Hoolahan of Irish sports writing at that time. You know, he says every ounce is iron, in his description of Dr. Pat, and they routinely describe him as the greatest athlete in the world. You know, there's not even an argument. And think of, you know, America had its own athletes and its own sports. No, this man was the greatest athlete in the world. That was without question. And he had come, as they later discovered, then he had come to conquer wrestling as kind of the next frontier in his career.
And it seems like he did do pretty well at the start. Now, in those days, was wrestling, you know, what it is now, not really a sport?
See, this is the problem. In Ireland, if you look at how Dan O'Mahony becoming world champion a few years earlier had been covered in Ireland, it was covered like a real genuine sporting achievement, which it wasn't at all. You know, it was just like it was run by a syndicate. They decided who was going to be world champion, and they decided the box office needed an Irish champion. Dan O'Mahony was perfect for that. Now, Dr. Pat arrives there as a genuine athlete and is put in against people and wins. You know, he's fighting characters like King Kong Kashi, the Octopus, and Chief Little Wolf. And these are all along the west coast of America and even up into Canada, I think, as well, along the west coast there. And he, you know, he's winning fights. I think he thinks that it's real and that it's competitive. And then he's about to discover it's not, that it's, right. It's actually, it's an arranged thing. And they wanted him to win a few fights, so maybe he could fight O'Mani, and that would be a great box office draw. And then finally, the whole thing comes crashing down, really. It's a very brief few months in his life, but he comes crashing down one night when he's put in with a guy called K.O. Coverley, who's supposed to be losing to Dr. Pat. That's the arrangement. And Coverley decides not to lose. And now whether he improvised that himself or whether he was told by the promoters, he basically beats up. He wraps his hands in this tape with a substance on it. And he beats up Dr. Pat. And to give you to tell you what the sport was like, the fight was declared a draw. Dr. Pat was covered in blood. It was declared a draw because they couldn't have him incurring a loss on the way to, you know, a possible fight against O'Mani. So after, and at the end, Dr. Pat was furious and he challenged Coverley to a boxing fight. He put up $1,000, you know, as a purse to fight him in under boxing rules and stuff like that. But that was basically the beginning of the end. The flirtation with wrestling, which, you know, was, as I said, more of an entertainment business than it was more show business than sport, really. Mm. And that was the end of it. It was a very brief flirtation. Within a few weeks, he was back in Ireland. And he gave an interview actually where he said one of the promoters came to him and said, "You can fight O'Mani, but you'll have to pay $25,000 out of your own pocket for the right to fight." So the whole thing was a bit of a scam. And it really, when you look at the overall arc of his incredible career and his wonderful life, really, when you think about it, because he became the doctor, he became, you know, a GP, a beloved GP in Clonmel and a stalwart of the Clonmel Commercials GA Club for most of his life. This was an unseemly kind of tawdry episode in Dr. Pat's life. You know, he got involved there with some unseemly characters and it didn't really become his legend to be getting down and dirty with these people.
Yeah. Was he bitter about it, that experience?
He doesn't seem to have been the kind of guy. I mean, there was a couple of interviews that he gave where he sounded pretty annoyed about the whole thing. But you know, his whole life, he seems to have been a very kind of stoic character. And he wasn't. And in fact, the interesting thing about it, if you read up about Dr. Pat, this became a couple of lines in his biography. You know, it really became a very small chapter in his life, really, in the overall, as I said, he had this extraordinary life. One of the great Irish sporting lives. You know, right up and, you know, as I said, he's involved in his local GA club for decades after that in Clonmel, where he was a doctor. And, you know, so this, I don't think he was exceptionally bitter about it. Certainly after 1938, there's no evidence of him giving interviews and kind of ranting and raving about how these promoters did him wrong, which they unquestionably did, by the way. Yes. They seemed to have lured him there under you know, they lured him there with money, obviously, and there's talk of $100,000 for 12 months, which is extraordinary money for 1938, but they also lured him there under false pretenses in terms of what he was actually getting into.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary story nonetheless. Dave Hannigan is a journalist, author and adjunct professor of history at Suffolk Community College on Long Island. Dave, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, John.
Moncrief on News Talk,
brought to you by Avant Money. Think you're getting the best value from your bank? Think again.